From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, is ISIS getting stronger?
I think their ideology is getting stronger. I'm never worried about their numbers and their Toyota truck.
Obama says the U.S. and Qatar are united in the fight against the Islamic State. WHO's billion-dollar appeal for four health emergencies. And the EU says an Iran nuclear deal is at hand. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yockey. New U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter held talks Monday in Kuwait with top U.S. commanders and diplomats on U.S. efforts to fight the Islamic State group. Officials said the meeting was to allow Carter to better understand the range of efforts being pursued to defeat the militant group. Fahim Yunus is an executive committee member of the Ahmadiyya Muslim Community of the U.S. and a senior fellow of the Center for Ethics at the University of Baltimore. We asked him what actions the U.S. should take to defeat ISIS.
I believe we are on the right track, and I admire the efforts that the president and his administration are making. It should be a multifaceted approach of working with the Arab countries, having them not only defeat this ideology by theological principles, but also by putting their army and boots on the ground and cutting the supply chain of ISIS. And then in the long run, like the president said, improve the economic conditions in these countries. And just the fact that hopefully the wars will end and they will see some prosperity, and therefore they will have a stronger identity about themselves and life will become worth living. So I believe it's a multifaceted approach as the president is pursuing.
Well, you're saying boots on the ground. Should that be an Arab coalition with the boots on the ground, or should the United States join those ground forces? The president's been a little hesitant about doing that.
As Ahmadiyya Muslim community, we strongly believe that these should be Arab countries, and not only because politically that's the right thing, but Susan, Islamically also that is the right thing to do, because ISIS looks at, you know, for them, there's a very small sliver of people who should be allowed to live, and they are trying to destroy the churches and mosques and synagogues. And there's a verse in Holy Quran that clearly says that such people should be stopped with force, because to protect religious freedom. So I believe not just politically, but Islamically and religiously as well, it is the duty of the Arab state.
Many people around the world see the members of ISIS as monsters. Why do they have so much power to recruit? Why does anybody join them?
That's a great question. And first of all, I again completely agree that they don't represent Islam. Nothing that they're doing is Islamic. But there is a lack of identity in that part of the world. The people have high rates of illiteracy. There is poverty. These wars have created a situation where the young minds are vulnerable. And therefore, these people who have deep resentments, and these are political resentments, their clergy is actually abusing certain verses in the Quran. I think we cannot just completely remove the fact that they have some connection with Islam. They have a very perverted, very complicated, skewed view of Islam. And it is the resentment that these wars over the past 10, 15 years have generated, which then make it very easy. You know, when we just callously call something collateral damage, and these are hundreds of thousands of orphans in the age of 10, 12, 15, we've pretty much given them a purpose to hate us. And that purpose is being exploited by the likes of ISIS.
Do you think ISIS is getting stronger at this time?
I think their ideology is getting stronger. I'm never worried about their numbers and their Toyota trucks. But I believe that it is their ideology that more and more people will join them if this anti-Islamic rhetoric that is now drumming up in America and Europe continues. Every time somebody tries to link it with Islam and calls them Islamic State and Islamic radicals, the president is absolutely right. This is what is going to generate more and more resentment among the Muslim youth, and this is what is going to allow ISIS to recruit more people and become stronger militarily.
Fahim Yunus, executive committee member of the Ahmadiyya Muslim Community of the U.S. and a senior fellow of the Center for Ethics at the University of Baltimore. U.S. President Barack Obama welcomed Qatar's emir to the White House Tuesday, calling the Arab country a strong partner in the battle to degrade and defeat the Islamic State militant group, which has taken large amounts of territory in Iraq and Syria. VOA correspondent Aru Pandey has more from the White House.
The visit by Qatari Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani, his first to the White House since he assumed power in 2013, comes just days after Qatar protested Egyptian airstrikes against Islamic State targets in Libya. Cairo launched the strikes last week after a video emerged showing the militant group murdering 21 Egyptian Christians. Qatar recalled its ambassador to Egypt to protest what it called unilateral action that could hurt innocent civilians, revealing a fracture in the coalition long touted by the Obama administration. But on Tuesday, the American president sat alongside Qatar's emir in the Oval Office and expressed appreciation for the work Qatar has done in coordinating with other members of the coalition in the fight. Mr. Obama said the U.S. and Qatar are committed to defeating Islamic State, supporting the Iraqi people, and stabilizing Syria. The two leaders also discussed the unrest in Yemen and Libya and the importance of bringing peace to the region.
I think we had a significant meeting of the minds in our shared belief that the more that we can work with all the countries in the region to try to find political solutions to problems, the more that we can reduce sectarian tensions in the regions and isolate violent extremists, the more effective we can be.
The Qatari emir was brief in his remarks, echoing the American president on the strong ties between his country and the U.S. Sheikh Tamim also expressed concern about the turmoil in the Middle East and North Africa.
We're concerned as well about the terrorist groups in our region. I think we all share the same view, the reason why those terrorist groups are growing in our region.
The remarks come from the leader of a country that U.S. Treasury officials say for years openly financed Hamas and allegedly supported extremist groups in Syria. Qatari officials have denied such allegations, and when asked about Qatar's alleged financing of extremist groups following Tuesday's talks, White House spokesman Josh Earnest told reporters that the U.S. does not necessarily agree with the Qatari government on every issue, but
the bottom line is that our interests with Qatar converge somewhat more often than they actually diverge. That Qatar has been of significant help on a range of regional issues, including Afghanistan, Iran. As you know, even the Qataris have even agreed to host a regional training site for the moderate Syrian opposition.
Earnest noted that the Qatari government also has been willing to work closely with the Obama administration on the issue of terrorism financing in preventing Islamic State from carrying out attacks. During the White House meeting, President Obama said he gave the emir an update on the Iran nuclear talks and the goal of ensuring that Iran does not have a nuclear weapon. The two leaders also discussed the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, with Sheikh Tamim noting Mr. Obama's commitment to finding a solution on the issue. Arup Pandey, VOA News at the White House.
President Barack Obama at last week's White House Summit on Violent Extremism acknowledged the need to address the political grievances that drive people to terrorist acts. He said violent extremism is fueled when people are oppressed, dissent is silenced, and human rights denied. A new Atlantic Council report makes the same point, but it challenges the notion that the United States must choose between its immediate security interests and broader institutional reforms in the Arab world. The authors argue that extremism and instability are symptoms and that the main drivers of the troubles in the Arab world are poor governance, failing economies, and political illegitimacy. They contend that to be successful, U.S. policy for the region must address these underlying issues that drive the political grievances. Co-author of the study, Faisal Itani, is a resident fellow at the Atlantic Council. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy about the recommendations contained in his report.
Mr. Itani, in his remarks at the summit on countering violent extremism, President Obama said, "We must recognize that lasting stability and real security require democracy." Would that contradict your report's argument that the U.S. policies favor stability over reform in the Arab world?
Not quite. And I believe that's because there's a fundamental dilemma that the Obama administration faces, and it plays out in their policies. I do believe President Obama actually genuinely believes this to be the case, that these are the core requirements for stability. They're rooted in good governance and democracy and other things he described. I also think, though, at the same time, this particular president and others before him have felt there actually isn't much the United States can do to advance that agenda. So you see a divergence between the rhetoric, some of which may be genuine, and the actual policy, which doesn't reflect or fall in line with that rhetoric.
Your report calls for a major shift in U.S. priorities to focus on the core elements of sustainable political and economic development in the region, arguing that extremism and instability are symptoms of poor governance, failing economies, and political illegitimacy. What are your recommendations?
Well, first, you know, there's two levels of crisis in the Middle East. There's a sort of slow-burning, insidious crises, and then there are the fires that are out of control in places like Iraq, Syria, and Libya. I think first we need to concentrate on the fires and limit the damage they're doing for the long-term prospects of stability in the Middle East. And that requires moving beyond a sort of short-term counter-terrorist approach that's very narrow and works with some questionable partners on the ground in places like Iraq, as well as the sort of hands-off approach we've taken towards Syria. In other places where we have amenable partners, the U.S. has plenty of tools. It has educational exchanges. It has business development tools. It has public and private diplomacy. And then there's finally the need to articulate and connect with civil society groups on the ground that are hoping to change the sort of the popular values of these sort of places, without which there cannot be a democratic shift and change.
So what tools could the United States use to prod Arab governments to advance pluralism, basic rights, and respect of human rights?
It requires a very broad approach. I believe it starts with orienting some aid and support towards private sector development, not just direct budgetary support, giving technical assistance to institutional reforms that improve the private sector, improve the investment climate, aiding security forces to operate in a transparent, disciplined manner, facilitating trade and investment between the United States, and also, I think most importantly, not seeing terrorism, the problem of terrorism, through a very narrow prism to be addressed with things like drone strikes and assassinations. We need to be much more ambitious than that. We need to be able to build local partnerships. We need to be able to understand how to create polities and societies in which the grievances that fuel things like Sunni and Shia jihadism can be addressed.
Final question. President Obama emphasized the need to deal with the economic grievances in the Arab world that terrorists exploit. How could the U.S. help in promoting sustainable economic development in the Arab world as a tool to fight extremism?
Our report mentions very specifically the issues of technical private sector assistance, educational exchanges, etc. But there's also politics wrapped up in this economic problem. I mean, a lot of these regimes, particularly insecure regimes that are heavily repressive or heavily paranoid, don't frankly have much appetite to take the kinds of risks potentially economically destabilizing that would open up economies and create jobs. A lot of these are obviously very elite-dominated economies, that in which, unless you belong to a tight circle of access, you're not going to have much economic opportunity. So this starts, to be honest with you, with political and institutional and legal reform, not just pure economics.
Faisal Itani, a resident fellow at the Atlantic Council. The World Health Organization is launching a $1 billion appeal to provide life-saving health services for 21 million people in the Central African Republic, Iraq, South Sudan, and Syria. The UN agency warns health conditions in all four countries are deteriorating because of raging conflicts that show no signs of abating. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization has launched its appeal on behalf of the entire health cluster of more than 30 international humanitarian organizations. The World Health Organization is running a 65% shortfall from last year's multi-million dollar appeal for the Central African Republic, Iraq, South Sudan, and Syria. It warns continued lack of support will have dire consequences for tens of millions of people. Most of the money, $687 million, will go for Syria, where 12.2 million people need humanitarian health support. WHO country representative for Syria, Elizabeth Hoff, says one of the biggest challenges is reaching people with aid. She notes 2.7 million people are residing in Islamic State-controlled areas, and another 4.8 million are living in other hard-to-reach areas.
People have more difficulties to cope particularly with the winter season, with a high number of respiratory diseases. But what is the main fear that WHO has as we are moving forward is really the risk of waterborne diseases. We have in 2014 31,460 cases of hepatitis A reported, and this normally we see in when the weather is warmer and so on, but it just tells you that people no longer have the same access to safe drinking water as before.
Nearly $219 million is needed to provide humanitarian health support for 4 million people in Iraq, more than half internally displaced by the IS onslaught. The country has been plagued by health crises since the first Gulf War two decades ago. The WHO says the country is suffering a serious shortage of life-saving medicines. It says child immunization rates are very low, and it is concerned about a resurgence of polio and an increase in measles. It says a major focus of its support will be on building up primary health care services as they can be made readily available for people in need. The agency is asking for $90 million to provide health care for 3.35 million people in South Sudan. WHO country representative Tarande Constant Manzila says getting to inaccessible areas will be very expensive.
Last year, for example, in 2014, we counted more than 300 UNHAS flights from out of Juba to deliver services and goods in the many states in more than 80 locations. The money is needed today for the purchase and the prepositioning of all the medical supply and also mounting operation to continue delivering health services during the rainy season, which is going to start at the end of May.
The WHO reports nearly 1.5 million people are in need of health support in the Central African Republic, and $48 million is required to provide services, including vaccinating children against measles and other killer disease, tackling malaria, respiratory infections, and life-threatening conditions such as obstetric emergencies. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The European Union's foreign policy chief says a deal on Iran's nuclear program is at hand, and she is optimistic it will be finalized before the March 24th deadline. VOA's Al Pessin reports from London, where Federica Mogherini spoke at the Chatham House Research Organization.
Mogherini said she's an Iran deal optimist, and there is a historic opportunity to reach a deal in the coming weeks.
A good deal is at hand if the parties will keep cooperating as they did so far, and if we'll have enough political will on all sides to agree on a good deal and sell it domestically.
European Union officials have been convening intensive talks in recent weeks among officials of Iran and the six nations designated by the United Nations to hold the talks. That has included several meetings between Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, who have cited unspecified progress. But Secretary Kerry told members of Congress Tuesday that while the negotiations have produced some benefits, including the temporary halt to parts of Iran's nuclear program, he's not yet sure the effort will succeed.
We've halted the progress of Tehran's nuclear program. We've gained unprecedented insight into it. And we expect to know soon whether or not Iran is willing to put together an acceptable and verifiable plan.
Negotiators have missed two previous deadlines, and officials say it will be difficult to convince skeptics on both sides to accept another extension. The talks are aimed at providing guarantees that Iran will not build a nuclear weapon and ending international sanctions against it. Mogherini acknowledged the effort faces opposition in Iran, where officials say their nuclear program is purely peaceful, but conservatives don't want any restrictions on it.
I'm 100% sure about Zarif's goodwill and political will to get the deal. And I would say the same for President Rouhani. But obviously, they have an internal domestic dynamic to be aware of.
She also noted opposition elsewhere, particularly among some members of the U.S. Congress, who do not trust Iran to abide by any accord. On Tuesday, Kerry urged them to wait to see what's actually in the deal if one is reached. Mogherini said it's part of her role to ensure that any deal is a good one and that it can be successfully implemented. And in spite of the opposition, the long detailed talks, and the two missed deadlines, she believes the negotiators will reach an agreement.
I think that after such an intensive and long negotiation, and with such an amount of political will from all sides, and being so close to a deal, I would say that we cannot miss this opportunity.
Diplomatic analysts say the consequences of a breakdown in the talks could be devastating, with Iran potentially rushing to make a nuclear weapon, perhaps within a very short time, and other nations possibly taking military action to stop it, as well as further increasing Iran's economic and political isolation. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
Scientists thought they knew a lot about how life works until a discovery more than two decades ago challenged conventional beliefs. Scientists found that there are organisms that breathe rocks. It is only recently that the scientific community is accepting that there are organisms that could get energy out of rocks. New discoveries are still being made, including organisms that also eat rocks. Here's Elizabeth Lee with the details.
Kenneth Nielsen can be described in many ways, including expert in microbiology and biochemistry. But that's not the one he is most proud of.
People call me the father of Shewanella.
Shewanella is an unusual bacterium that shocked the scientific community. Nielsen discovered it 25 years ago in a lake. Like other organisms, it breathes oxygen, but it also breathes rock. Nielsen looks at a time-lapse video of the Shewanella breathing rock. It shows a piece of manganese oxide slowly disappearing over several hours.
That particle that you saw disappear before your eyes in 18 hours, under those conditions, should have been stable for thousands of years.
All living things, including people, make energy through what's called electron transfer. It involves taking electrons from the food we eat.
When we breathe in oxygen, we give electrons to it, and it's that voltage that allows us to make energy.
This process usually happens internally. But for the Shewanella and other mineral-breathing organisms, the electron transfer happens outside the cell. When the process was first discovered, it seemed impossible to the scientific community.
This was one of the most exciting times in my career, when you realize that you have something that probably no one else has and that almost no one's going to believe.
Since then, microbiologists have found other organisms that breathe metal. And Nielsen says they are finally making it into science textbooks. Building on Nielsen's work, one researcher in his lab, Annette Rowe, just made another discovery. Bacteria that eat rock in ocean sediments as an energy source and transfer electrons from outside the cell membrane into the cell.
So you don't actually have to internalize it to get energy from it.
It's going to be as wacky as the 15 years ago, 25 years ago. Because you could see from the reviews of this that some people just didn't believe it. Okay, and they didn't want to believe it.
These findings have implications that extend to outer space and how life might exist on a planet like Mars. Nielsen says one of his former students is now building this instrument that will attach to the arm of a rover and give scientists a special set of eyes on the 2020 Mars mission.
If you picked up a nice fluorescent signal from a Mars rock or a sediment or a core, if we could drill into it, and all of a sudden you saw certain colors of fluorescence, you would say, well, stop the train. Let's get a sample of this and look at it in more detail.
Meanwhile, scientists are drilling into the lower parts of the Earth's crust, several kilometers down, to see if there are forms of life there, living in ways much different than what we know as life on the surface. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day. That's 24 hours a day on our website. And you know where that is, voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.